My name's Kevin, and I'm an alcoholic. And today we're celebrating after 26 years of having gone to recovery rehab. I have 10 years today for the first time ever, and I am really pleased. And went to a meeting yesterday and brought the topic, and my topic, it's a quote meeting. You bring a quote, and I brought a quote. It takes what it takes. And for me, that was about self-compassion. I wasn't one of the lucky ones that got to come into my first meeting and stay sober forever. Because if I had, I'd have like 39 years. But that's not the case. And so I have 10 years. But still, way better to have 10 years than pretty much any other alternative available to me. And the way we usually start this meeting is we've given up on scripts and doggone stuff. And I share a little video from Bessel van der Kolk. It's about rubbing, and it's called the emotional freedom technique, or what other people will call tapping. And so, oh, I'm going to try and bring it up here. And here we go. And so, if you'll play along with me, this is Bessel van der Kolk, the author of The Body Keeps the Score. And what he does is this tapping thing. He starts in the back of his hand. You can't see it below the screen when he starts. But if you do rubbing, I find it to be more effective. He does tapping, tap, tap, tap. But one of our members, Patty O, pointed out that tapping, that rubbing works really well for her. And this helps us get centered, head and gut, mind and body, whatever. But it goes for 2 minutes, and that's how we start the meeting.
Do what I'm doing and just notice what happens in your body as you do that. And so in tapping, you start off tapping what the Chinese call a reversal point. Being a Western doctor, I don't quite know what that means, but you just go with it. And so you tap over here between your fourth and fifth metaphalanx and just notice what happens to your breathing, to your body, where you do that. And then you tap a second reversal point, the back of your hand, like this. Because I do it a lot, I have quite a reaction to it myself. If you have never done this before, you probably have not much of a reaction. The next place you tap is over here, your orbital prefrontal, superciliary ridge is called. Just tap there. The next place you tap is your zygomatic arch over here.
Rihanna had a hit with this
Next
song, which
point
also
is your
protects you from the rain.
infraorbital
You
ridge
got
over here. Just notice your body, notice your breath, upper lip, lower lip, and then find acupressure point number 27 is 1 inch below your collarbone, about 1 inch on either side of your sternum. And it's a spot here that's more sensitive than other spots in your body. You tap over here, and then finally, you tap over here. Between your 11th and 12th rib, and then I end up over here. Other people teach you different sequences, and that's all good. We really don't know what the best sequence is, but as you do this, something changes. What we see change actually when you tap is it changes what is known. I think Dan Siegel was the first person to use this term, is you change the window of tolerance. You change people's F.
And so that's tapping, and We get kind of grounded here and usually we'll check in and see how it's going. But today, I'm going to plan on blathering a lot. Marilyn hosts a few meetings, and her great line is, "If you think you're rambling, you probably are." Oh my God, it's on. I'm going to be rambling for a while here. And yeah, but I kind of start with a picture of me in my childhood, and what I was this is my brother Bryce and my sister Valerie and my dogs Lobo and Sheba, and this meeting in the book we've been reading is about divergent minds, neurodiversity. And it's written by a woman named Janara Nirenberg. We're almost done with the book, but in a way, I've always been trying to rescue Valerie in my recovery. Because shortly after this picture, I'm sure I was 14 in that picture. A year later, Valerie was dead from suicide. And 6 months after that, Bryce killed himself in a Air Force ROTC training flight. It was his first training flight. And for decades, I thought that was the worst day of my life. I was in wrestling in high school and was a sophomore. Did pretty well. I beat on a couple of seniors and made varsity. And I only got pinned one time in my high school career, but that was that day. My dad came to town. We lived 8 miles out of town and picked me up, and he was crying on the way home. Couldn't say why, and I had to play the guessing games. I figured out that my brother had killed himself in a plane crash. But they were both overachievers. Valerie had graduated high school early, and she'd been the captain of this drill team and the swim team, and was going to a local community college where my sister Karen was the student body president. And Bryce had been the captain of the football and wrestling team in high school. And he even got voted Mr. Physique in high school, for being whatever, the studliest, cutest, most popular guy or something. But there's a whole lot of backstory to that in that, I'm pretty sure after studying this trauma stuff, I learned so much in the last 5 years. Thanks to Xander having started that neurodiversity meeting on Sunday. When I first went there, I went there as a guy in a wheelchair to be supportive of other people with disabilities. But, after a couple of meetings, I was like one of those guys who comes to an AA meeting because the judge said he had to, or rehab said he had to. And he's, "Oh, I'm here because I have to be." And then about three meetings in or something, he goes, "Yeah." And you can just see the relief coming over him. Well, I had that same experience coming to their Sunday meeting and realizing that I was probably autistic, which I don't know what the scientific definition of it is, but you can think of it as having relationship issues. And it's not altogether inaccurate. And so for a couple of years, I thought I was autistic. And then we started studying trauma too. And now I'm not so sure that I'm autistic, but I definitely got a lot of trauma. And, I think there's a really good chance that my mom, no, she was definitely messed up. My sister thinks she had a borderline personality disorder, but there's probably a really good chance what she really was is traumatized herself, because her mom died when she was 6 years old from cancer, and she got the wicked stepmother and sent off to boarding schools, and chances are really good she missed out on a whole bunch of nurturing herself. And definitely got shortchanged on the nurturing myself. My other brother Bryce was quite the apple of her eye. But yeah, she I don't think she clicked with me. She started going to college shortly after I was born, and we didn't spend a lot of time together, and I can track back to missing things. Had I been better organized, I was going to show you some pictures of the farm I grew up in. And one of the first real major traumas, aside from that whole lack of nurturing childhood thing, was when I was 5 years old. We were playing in the hay barn, kind of unsupervised. Like, my parents were like, leave us be. We were definitely some free range kids. But they all lit a match in the hay barn and blew it out and ran off. And then they handed me the matchbook, well, before they ran off, and I lit my first match. And then I didn't know what to do with it. And it burned my fingers, so I dropped it. And it burned the entire fucking hay barn to the ground when it was full of hay. And my dad was a pilot, and he came home late from a trip. He was supposed to have already been home, and this barn's burned to the ground, and he's pretty upset, and he beat me with a club until it broke. Then he got another club and beat me some more. And I always kind of thought that was the day I went insane. We got here and we reverse engineer the second step, talks about being restored to sanity. And I would think that was the day I went insane. But having studied this trauma stuff more, that was definitely a big dose of fuel on the fire, but pretty sure I missed that, little kid, kind of talk and stuff. But man, rebuilt the farm, and we had this gasoline powered welder down there. And so when we were, I don't know, 6 or 8 years old, we would go down there, and Bryce, he got to be kind of the dictator of the kids. He was the oldest, and my sister Karen and Valerie, and then a couple years later there was me. But we would sniff gas off the gas tank from the welder, and I'm thinking about it, sort of my claim to fame is, and when we'd like sniff so much gas, we'd be pretty much blacked out. You'd get these weird hallucinations, and I call them the dizzles. And didn't get to name too many things on the farm, but I got to name that first high. So kind of fast forward 10 years or something, and I'd hang out with the neighbor kids, and we'd smoke really crappy pot, and maybe drink a beer or something like that when, young teens, 14, 15. But I was kind of a jock geek. I was doing football and wrestling, albeit not very well. And then I stuck with the wrestling, and I went from being what I perceived as kind of chubby and uncoordinated to being more coordinated and less chubby. And then through junior high, and then by the time I got to high school, at first I made varsity, and then I did better in the tournaments they have. And by the time I was a senior, I made it on to being a league champion, and I was pretty good at it. I went to the state tournament and pinned the kid who got third, but I also met my sister that, or my future brother-in-law that day. We went to a Mexican restaurant, and I ate chips and salsa for hours and drank like 2 gallons of water. Then I had to lose weight to make it to the next day of the rest state tournament, and I lost in overtime. Otherwise, I would have placed in the state tournament. But it's just one of many examples of me snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. Got to be really good at that. And so, made it through high school. By the end of it, my mom had become just a raging alcoholic. She was a junior high vice principal. She'd won like a couple of sex discrimination lawsuits because it was the old boys' club and they wouldn't let the girls be the vice principals. And she won these lawsuits and got to be a vice principal, but it was kind of a pyrrhic victory in that she wasn't very happy doing that. But and she'd come home and bitch about kids doing something, and my dad and I were singularly unsympathetic, and we'd say, kick them out. It didn't matter what problem she'd bring home, we'd kick them out. Yeah, I know I got at least a half a dozen kids kicked out of school for smoking on the way to school or causing some trouble or another. All right. After Bryce died, Ma dove into a bottle and just pickled herself, and she was the angriest drunk I've ever known. She had that vice principal ability to really chew on people, and she tended to chew on me. She'd get mad at things I would do or whatever, and her ultimate thing was to threaten to disinherit me. And I always kind of figured I would be and just left it at that. And she died, less than a year ago. She lost her mind with dementia at 95. But we've become friends now. And I keep her here with me. And so me and Mom hang out. And we get along great now. She ain't got shit to say. And I don't really pull her up too often. It was kind of funny when I first got her urn, like last October. But she's there, and I've got to do some healing on that relationship. And so when I tried to go to college at 18 after high school, I started out in a sort of advanced math program in eighth grade. And by the time I was a senior in high school, we started with 60 kids. And by the time I was a senior, we were down to six kids taking calculus. And I burned out and bailed out on calculus. And so that was the first time I failed calculus. And kind of went off into the trades programs, which were designed for the flaky kids or whatever, and took auto shop and stuff. But then it was senior year of high school and graduated. And I should have been lined up for like the University of Washington, our big local school, but I just wasn't into it. And so at the last minute, I did sign up for the local community college at my parents' behest. And I lasted about a month and dropped out. I wasn't into it. And so I found a job with the neighbor guy and went and worked as a logger. It was 1977, and Seattle used to be this big center of harvesting natural resources, the forests, like the trees behind me, and fish. Like high school teachers, they would teach, for 9 months of the year, and then they'd go down to the ocean and harvest salmon for 3 months and supplement their income. That was pretty much a thing of the past in 1977. For a variety of reasons. Primarily, they chopped down all the trees and caught all the fish. And, tried to get a variety of jobs after that for the next several years. And kind of bounced around between smoking pot and drinking on the weekends. And, worked some construction jobs as a manual laborer. And pretty much work all week, make a bunch of money, and spend it on pot and alcohol on the weekend, and be kind of broke for the next week. And I was making almost a living wage at 19 years old or something. It worked out that my sister and brother-in-law were going to buy a mobile home and put it on the family farm. And so they bought a big, giant, round concrete thing to use as a septic tank. And we had a backhoe, and so I installed the septic tank at like 19, and we had a surveyor's transit and stuff, and I knew how to use all that. And so I put in the pipes at grade and put in the septic tank and wired up a gravity feed water system for him. But they decided they didn't want to live on the farm for it was pretty remote, and also they didn't want to be that close to my parents. And so there was this place all set up for a mobile home, and when I was 19, I bought a mobile home and put it on the family farm and kind of lived on the grid, off the grid out there. The only bill I had was for the phone bill, and even that I struggled to pay. Finally, the power company caught on. There had been a power meter in the middle of the pasture. I had wired up to it without authorization, and had like free electricity for like 6 months or a year until they caught on. Then I had to pay it back. But so there I was living in this mobile home. For whatever reason, I decided I wanted to be a timber cutter. And I had a chance on, I'd live like kind of a river route selling wet firewood during the winter and logging or bricklaying, carrying bricks for bricklayers. They call that a hod carrier during the summer. And it was sort of an existence, but finally it was about time to grow up. And anyway, I'd had a party, and there had been some incidents with me, like forging state documents. Government made these pretty nice fake IDs to supplement my income for a year. And, oh, the cops knew I did it and were kind of bugging me about it, but I didn't admit it. And it was a didn't last but 4 or 5 months, and I got rid of that thing. It was way too hot to be forging government documents for me. And they were mad. These King County sheriffs were mad at me. And this is right around the time of Ted Bundy, one of America's most prolific serial killers. And then we had the Green River Killer. And nobody knew about the Green River Killer at that time, but he'd been out there killing prostitutes on the Seattle strips and such. And these King County sheriffs could have either caught, two serial killers or go beat the shit out of local kids. And they chose to come on over to my place, 75 strong. And they arrested like 13 of my friends and stuff like that. And tear gassed my home and slashed my tires. And I got found guilty of six misdemeanors, resisting arrest, inciting a riot, things like that. And didn't actually have to do any jail time or anything over it. They came to the party, tried to arrest me, and I was pretty physically fit at that time from being a timber cutter. And so these five cops had me down, and I got away from them and jumped over the fence. And I was just totally bewildered by their behavior. But then they came back 75 strong an hour or two later. It got crazy. But so I had this probation thing. But by this time, I was 21. I was ready to go join the Army Corps of Engineers. And I was going to be a civil engineer and build big giant roads and dams and stuff like, because the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is the biggest construction outfit in the world. And it was going to be cool. I was into that outdoor kind of tractor lifestyle. Grew up on that farm, and I was pretty good with equipment and dirt and stuff. Easily the best of us four kids. But it didn't quite happen because I was on probation, couldn't join. And so I went and worked in Mount St. Helens 6 months after it blew up. It blew up on May 18th, 1980. In January of 1981, I went down there and went long, and it was pretty cool, really. We're on this hillside, and over here was Mount St. Helens and the V. We kind of looked northwest into the gap. Couldn't see the very bottom of the volcano, but you could sort of see in. And we could watch it smoking and steaming and do that thing where we get the logs and drag them out of the volcanic ash that was 6 or 8 inches deep where we were and send them off on a truck to town. And then down below us on the other side was where they had this so-called barrier dam. Basically, it was a series of dirt dams where they were trying to settle the silt out of the river before it washed away all these other waterways and flooded towns and things like that. But we finished off logging the 90-acre site we were on, and we were moving the site and to a different place, and they were going to shut the mountain down the next day, so we couldn't go in to go logging due to increased volcanic danger. And so we moved the big giant piece of machinery that we used to drag the logs around, called a yarder. It's a bunch of steel cable and winches and things like that. And they had me at a semi truck with a fifth wheel hook up to the big giant yarder, still kind of mostly assembled, but rigged so we could drag it down a logging road. Couldn't drag it down a highway like that, but we moved in 4 or 5 hours, and I was on a tractor called a skidder behind it, and I'd push it up the hill and beat the brakes going down the hill. And so we got to the new job site and parked it there, and it's time to quit for the weekend. That was a Thursday afternoon. And I was going to drive the skidder halfway down the hill, and so that way next week we could go back to the old site and clean it up, move the rest of the equipment. And I think I was a little bit hypothermic, but I was driving that skidder WFO wide fucking open, going down this straight, brand new logging road. And there's been a spot where it washed out and the road got rough. And I crashed that 30,000-pound tractor over the top of myself and pretty much got cut in two by the roll cage. And I was paralyzed at 22. And that was the day I was going to quit the logging job and go join the Corps of Engineers. Another one of those snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. And so then, fast forward onto that to, well, I really talked for a long time and haven't got nearly so far in the story. I'm going to speed it up considerably, but, yeah, so I got paralyzed and went to the local Big Giant Trauma Hospital here in Seattle. It's just a world-class hospital, kind of dumpy. It serves the street people and stuff like that too, but it's a part of the University of Washington's medical school and really kind of overpowered for the region, but it's really great. But got to fall in love with my rehab nurse from the hospital. I got out of the hospital, and then we started dating a few months later. And oh, she was this cute blonde nurse, and so we ran away and moved to paradise. And I lived in Hawaii for a year. And, oh, I got rock fever there, and I don't know, just didn't feel like a good match for me. And so I ended up going to the University of California. Tried to get into Berkeley, or perhaps most prestigious public university in America. And didn't quite make it there, but I got into the university UC system at Santa Barbara. And one of my instructors told me you could do a backdoor transfer and get into, what was known as a party school, because the school's initials were UCSB, or You Can Study Buzzed. And it was right there on the beach. Turned out it was flat, warm, and dry, pretty ideal for a guy in a wheelchair. And somehow I met the guy who was going to be my cocaine dealer for the next 5 years, my first day there. And I picked chemical engineering and was a really crappy student because, I was kind of busy doing cocaine a whole bunch of the time. In my first quarter there, I learned how to play wheelchair tennis, and I was out playing these Southern California tennis tournaments, 6 weekends out of 10. Yeah, I flunked calculus for the second time, and oh, that was a really bad start to my engineering student career. And so the third try, I got an A, but I did better and worse, and I got into chemical engineering, which was pretty prestigious back in the day. They might call it process engineering now, but back then it was the highest paid undergraduate degree in America. And, oh, my classmates went on to work as All kinds of things. Oil field engineers and things like that are doing heat transfer on computers and things. But I had this thing with my job where I got paralyzed. I got a pension and included lifetime medical and a lifetime annuity. But had I graduated college, I would have been considered vocationally rehabilitated and got cut off from the pension and the medical thing. And so I got to be a senior of the year and a speaker at graduation, but never actually graduated because you needed a 2.0 and I got a 197. Once again, fucking up the big event by the skin of my teeth. And I came back to Seattle. And I thought about moving to these other cool places. I figured global warming is going to happen and down to Chile or maybe somewhere in New Zealand or Australia or Barcelona, Spain, to go for that nice Santa Barbara environment, the Mediterranean environment. In the end, I told myself with global warming going to happen, I'd come back to Seattle and it'd be warmer here. Yeah, seems to have held true. And see, it all worked out all right for me. But I tried to save the world with these, ended up starting three charities. Knowing that I had much more opportunity than other people did, not for any particular reason, but because I had this knack for reading the bulletin board at the student and financial aid office or whatever, and signed up for vocational rehabilitation. And I could see where there's scholarships for other kids and stuff. And so I wanted to. Try and save the world and help other people. And this is 1988, 1989. And I thought I'd, create basically a computer bulletin board set up and help other people with disabilities. And it worked out pretty well in a sense. Two of the three charities I started back around 1990 are still in existence. One's for fisheries enhancement. One's for, we put computers in the local King County libraries, which really might have been my biggest impact on the world, albeit a small part of it. It was a team of us. Because the King County library system is second only to the New York City library system in the number of books checked out each year. It's really popular library system. And when they put computers connected to the internet into their library system, they really impacted the world because, as far as I know, pretty much every library system has a computer in it now. It was that battle of the haves and have-nots. And I got to be one of the haves. I got an IBM computer in 1984. It was my second year at Santa Barbara. Oh, what a blessing that was. Because the other kids would have to go to the computer lab and sign up for time and use a computer. I could just use one in my bedroom. It was this technological advantage that definitely brought my grade point up by a couple of tenths just by knowing how to use a computer. All that stuff. And it worked out well. But after a couple of years of that charity stuff around 1992 or so, it was not nearly as redeeming as I would hoped it'd be. And I kind of did it in this engineering mentality of kept people away and just had these ideas. You guys should do this. And then I had these alcoholic roommates. Got tired of their nonsense and they left. And I was growing some weed and I had a wheelchair accessible grow room. And it was just enough weed to buy some crack when the neighbor kid came by, like the day after I kicked out the alcoholics. I immediately cured my alcohol and pot addiction by becoming a crackhead. And that lasted for 6 or 7 years. And, it was definitely kind of grateful to the crack addiction because it took me down in a way the alcohol and pot never would have. In the end, I was living in this rebuilt flop house in downtown Seattle, right next to the crack park. And, you know, I'd be the only white guy out there in a wheelchair at 4 in the morning trying to buy dope on the streets. You know, having this sort of adventure in my mind, you know, clearly insane. And finally, some guys tried to mug me, and I knew my time there was over. I moved back with my mom and had an issue of using it and said, you know, I had to go, and asked her if she'd help me to go to rehab. And said it wasn't worth the money because, you know, it'd never stick. And, you know, one thing I remember my mom saying, a couple of things, you know, there was that you're disinherited thing when I was a teenager. And then when I was 22 and I got paralyzed, I was laying in this like vet clinic of a hospital. And I was pretty smashed up with 6 broken ribs and 2 punctured lungs. And most people, when they get paralyzed, they just get like a tap in their back and the bruising and swelling leaves them paralyzed. I had exploded my 12th thoracic vertebrae into 32 bone chips from that tractor landing on me. And so there I am in the emergency room. They let my That was her version of support after I got paralyzed. She wasn't the most nurturing mother ever. And it says my internet's coming unstable, so if I start to break up, let me know and I'll turn the camera off. Yeah, so there I was, you know, 38 years old or so, and living with mom and being stuck as kind of a crack addict, where I'd get a pension check, go out, smoke crack, come back home, sleep for a week or two, and do it again. She kicked me out, and I was living in my car, and the car was kind of dying. And one day, the car was pretty much dead, and I was out of money and out of dope. So I went into that big giant hospital in Seattle because it was also the big giant psychiatric ward, and tried to get into the psychiatric ward because I knew from my sister Valerie that, you know, there's only one sequence that works. Either I could try and get help, then kill myself, or just kill myself and miss out on the help thing. And that was definitely one of my bottoms there. I went in there and I was just bawling and sobbing. And the nurse that checks you in, and they didn't have a bed in the psychiatric ward, so couldn't let me in there. But turns out that I had some health problems with my spinal cord injury that they probably wouldn't have admitted me for normally. But you've seen what kind of shape I was in. They gave me a bed on the rehab ward. I had a bed sore in my butt. They gave me a bed for that for a couple of days. And then a bed opened up in the psych ward, and they let me in there. I was estranged from my sister Karen. We were never very close as kids. She was the smartest one of us, and she got to go off to a private school with the smart rich kids. And Bryce and Valerie and I stayed on the farm, much to our detriment. And they convinced me to give the hospital staff her phone number, and they called her, and she came over. And oh, basically, she kind of took over my life and my money. She had an MBA and a CPA. And so I got out, and she helped me get an apartment. And she was running my money because I was, you know, 40 years old, 39 years old, functionally incompetent of being able to, like, pay my rent. You know, I'd spend it on drugs. And even so, I found a way to do more drugs, but she told me it's time to go off to rehab and had me set it up, and I did, and went to rehab 26 years ago this month and got out, and I really wanted to stop using, but it was a hop, skip, and a jump for me. And got 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. Some of the guys I was using with would come by with like a kibble of dope, and it wasn't like falling off the wagon, it was like being pushed. I've never seen more emphatic proof in my life of misery loves company than these guys coming by and knowing that I wanted to get sober. I didn't have to go there for the law and my liver and my lover. I just wanted to be done. And they'd come by with this kibble of dope hoping to get me started so I'd, go spend all my money with them or something. And my sister bought a condo with a doorman in the next town over. Stepped up in a big way. And I lived there for a year and I got moved in on the day after Christmas of 1999. And I got 5 years of sobriety and relapsed for a day. And then I got another, it was almost 6 years, another almost 6 years relapsed. And then I struggled for a couple of years. And then I got on this streak, and so here I am. And I've learned so much in secular recovery. I'm so grateful for that. We saw things like Jeffrey Munn's, staying sober without God. And I was pretty much an atheist. I didn't really have much of a problem with the God thing. It seemed a little weird to me. God is everything, or He is nothing. And I had tried foxhole prayers when I was a kid, God is a pilot and He'd be gone, and I was supposed to have done these chores on the farm. I was, please, God, if you get me out of this one, I'll be good forever. Well, He never got me out of that one, and I was never good forever. And, so doing like the third step or the sixth and seventh step, that didn't really make sense to me, but, I kind of mouthed the words and went along, and certainly life got better. And one experiment I clearly remember doing early on was, I could do all my own worrying, or I could turn the worrying over to God and go do like the next indicated thing. And I could see which way went better. And inevitably, turning the worrying over to God and doing the next indicated thing went better. Gone back to college for like a computer certificate just to get a be up to date and get a job. And when it came to doing the homework, and you could worry about learning it, or I could just study and not worry about it. And turned out studying went way better that way. And so that was about as close to that spiritual thing as I had. And I'm totally incapable of telling a story with a linear start to finish, but I'm much better now than I used to be. And so, way back when I did get paralyzed that day, kind of like died and saw God and saw my brother and sister Valerie in heaven. And I think that might be just a result of that white light thing. That might be just a result of your brain starving for oxygen. I don't really attribute it to any super deity thing, but I had that experience. It's and it was like God drew me back because I was a 6-inch fish in an 8-inch lake. And by that metaphor, I meant He had a thing to go do in my life and to go accomplish or something to learn or whatever. I think I've got it now. I'm learning how to be sober and live with other people and kind of be a service to people, Certainly do my little hosting thing on Tosnua and these neurodiversity meetings, and I know it's helped other people a little bit, And one of those things that I've learned in recovery is we get to save the world one person at a time. I had those big master plans, after college, starting these charities and saving the world. Oh, I don't have the charisma. There's some guy who started Earth Day 50 years ago, and apparently he had the charisma to pull it off, but I didn't have that. And So yeah, I get to come in here and host a few meetings and go to a few meetings and talk to a few people. But one of the things I've done is I lived in a condo for a year. Then my sister got a divorce and bought a bigger condo on the 16th floor, and it was really cool. I had this sliding door that looked out on Mount Rainier, beautiful view. Kind of like if you look at the picture Janice sometimes has posted of Mount Rainier, it looked like that right out my big giant, sliding door, 2 meters by 2 meters, Mount Rainier, 16th floor. But I wasn't getting along with my sister so good, and the deal had changed. She was going to live in Australia and have this cool condo. Instead, her and her Australian hubby lived here. So I moved to this apartment 23 years ago. It works really well for me. It's got a parking lot right level with my doorway that way, and I got a daylight basement out here, which means I'm, the story above the lawn out there. So my cats get their own little private deck, and they got little cat doors, and they can run in and out and stuff. But yeah, and so the conclusion I've got from all the neurodiversity stuff has really given me a bunch of peace and insights. And I always figured it was nature or nurture from the get-go that I became an addict. And now I've kind of revised that a little bit, and that I was in pain and I self-medicated. And most of that pain was psychic pain and whatever, family of origin kind of trauma. I do got a chronic pain from the being paralyzed and a weird kind of arthritis thing, but it's mild. And so there you have it. Wow. That was the longest I've ever talked in my life. And I hope you guys got something out of it. I am really proud to have 10 years. I didn't think I'd ever get it. And I did it with you guys. And I'm so grateful to have found the Testnua family of recovery. Mark and Rose. Marcella, I love you, Marcella. You're the craziest, hottest girl I know. And she came and visited me all the way from England to Seattle. Well, her sister lives the next town over. And I hope you come back and visit again. And Janice. So, yeah, the two people I've actually met from secular recovery in 5 years are both right next to each other on my screen, Janice and Marcella. But my Bellevue is a pretty upscale city here in this Silicon Forest with a, Amazon and Microsoft are headquartered here. And so we sometimes jokingly refer to our problems as Bellevue problems. And my Bellevue problem today is I have to go buy a new car. And I could afford to do that, and it's kind of weird how it happens, and it comes with weird constraints, but yeah, that's my Bellevue problem today. I have to buy a new car. And then I'll probably have to, yeah, there's me and Marcella together on the tallest restaurant in the area. We were at this steakhouse, and it was really nice. And yeah, the best hamburger I ever had, too, by the way. It was a Wagyu burger. And Marcella had coffee. Yeah. There's a notice there about when you go out to eat with Marcella. Well, if you eat like I do, she'll take her napkin and brush the food off of you. But, yeah. And thank you all, Alina, the people who have made the, like the music hour, go and hang out at that. And Jenny's been with me through thick and thin on those neurodiversity meetings. Harry in France. Bridget, started a Monday night meeting. Had a really great time there. Tom playing your music. And Patty O is actually going to be our guest author for the next time we're almost done with the book we're reading now, The Divergent Minds. And so when we finish that, we're going to start Patty O's book about, yeah, I paraphrase the title is How to Be a Functional Neurodivergent Adult. I don't know. That might be the high standard for the book because nobody else has made me functional in 66 years, but we'll see. And yeah, but thank you all for my birthday party and celebrating 26 years of recovery and 10 years of sobriety. I love you very much. Thank you for the life I have today. I'm as happy as I've ever been.